Hello and welcome. In the aftermath of World War II, the victorious Allied powers, above all the United States, the Soviet Union, and Britain, rounded up the most important leaders of defeated Germany, who are still alive, formally charged them as having been war criminals, and brought them as defendants before the Great Nuremberg Trial of 1945-1946, officially known as the International Military Tribunal, or IMT. The German leaders were put on trial, in the words of the indictment, as major war criminals for what they called various war crimes, crimes against peace, and crimes against humanity. In the words of the tribunal's charter, these Nazi conspirators carried out their crimes as part of a great common plan or conspiracy. In addition, 12 secondary Nuremberg trials, the NMT trials, were organized by the U.S. government alone and conducted from 1946 to 1949. Similar trials were also conducted by the British at Lüneburg and Hamburg and by the United States at Dachau. Hitler, of course, was dead at the end of the war, along with Goebbels and Himmler. So among the most prominent surviving German leaders who were brought before the Nuremberg Tribunal, the number one defendant was Hermann Göring, who had been Reich Marshal and commander of Germany's wartime air force. Other prominent tribunal defendants were wartime armaments minister Albert Speer, foreign minister Joachim von Ribbentrop, and Karl Dönitz, chief of the submarine fleet and then commander of the German Navy, and Alfred Jodl, who was chief of staff of the German armed forces. The purpose of the Nuremberg Tribunal, which was given tremendous media coverage by the victorious powers, was to persuasively prove to the world, not least to the defeated Germans, that the Third Reich's leaders had been men of great, even unique, deceit, rapaciousness, and evil. Because in our society the Holocaust story continues to play such a large role, even so many years after the end of the war, in our motion pictures, our mass media, and in our educational and cultural life generally, one might easily think that the main charge against the defendants was with regard to the wartime treatment of Europe's Jews. But that was not the case. The main goal of the Nuremberg Tribunal was to prove that the German leaders were guilty, first and foremost, of so-called crimes against peace, that is, planning and waging World War II, the most destructive war in history. That was the first and main charge against the defendants. Well, in reality, the Nuremberg Tribunal was itself an illegal enterprise, one that dispensed not justice, but injustice. It violated a basic and universally recognized principle of justice because it operated on the basis of what it is called ex post facto law, that is, on the basis of law invented after the supposed crime. The U.S. Constitution specifically prohibits ex post facto law. The European version of this is the principle from ancient Roman law of no punishment without a crime. The Nuremberg Tribunal dispensed not justice, but injustice. The hangings of German leaders ordered by the tribunal were little more than murders glossed over with a veneer of fake, makeshift judicial legitimacy. Justice, as opposed to vengeance, is a standard that is applied impartially. At Nuremberg, though, standards of justice applied only to the vanquished. The four Allied powers that sat in judgment were themselves guilty of many of the very crimes they accused the German leaders of committing. In conducting the Nuremberg trials, the Allied governments operated on the basis of a double standard. The Allied powers themselves violated international law. This was privately acknowledged by the chief U.S. prosecutor at Nuremberg, Robert Jackson. In a private letter to President Truman, Jackson wrote that the Allies, and I quote, have done or are doing some of the very things we are prosecuting the Germans for. The French are so violating the Geneva Convention in the treatment of German prisoners of war that our command is taking back prisoners sent to them for forced labor in France. We are prosecuting plunder, and our allies are practicing it. We say aggressive war is a crime, and one of our allies asserts sovereignty over the Baltic states based on no title except conquest. In violation of the first Nuremberg count of, quote, planning, preparation, initiating, or waging a war of aggression, unquote, the Soviet Union attacked Finland in December 1939 and as a result was expelled from the League of Nations. A few months later, the Red Army invaded Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia and ruthlessly incorporated those countries into the Soviet Union. In the main Crimes Against Peace section of the Allied indictment, the German defendants were charged, for example, of having, quote, planned, prepared, initiated, and waged, unquote, war against Britain and France beginning on September 3, 1939. Well, this charge underscores the spirit and character of the entire Nuremberg proceeding, because it was on that date, September 3, 1939, that Britain and France declared war against Germany. Far from planning or even intending war against those two countries, Hitler and the other German leaders wanted nothing more than to avoid war or conflict with Britain and France. The post-war French government violated international law and the Nuremberg Charge of, quote, maltreatment of prisoners of war, by employing large numbers of German prisoners of war as forced laborers in France. In 1945, the United States, Britain, and the Soviet Union jointly agreed to the brutal deportation of more than 10 million Germans from their ancient homes in Eastern and Central Europe, a violation of the Nuremberg Count of, quote, deportation and other inhumane acts committed against any civilian population, unquote. While the Allied prosecutors charged the defendants with a crime against peace in planning the German invasion of Norway in 1940, the British government eventually had to admit that Britain and France were themselves guilty of the very same crime in preparing a military invasion of Norway, codenamed Stratford, before the German attack. Already in the autumn of 1939, Winston Churchill, who was at that time the head of the British Navy, and later in 1940 Prime Minister, was already laying out plans for detailed invasion of Norway and the destruction of ore ports in Norway. This was worked out by the British Chief of Staff. The Allies were far more interested in denying high-grade ore to the Reich than they were in outflanking Germany. Both France and Britain were devoted to this project and believed that the neutrality of the Scandinavian countries was a snare and a delusion, and so the Allies intended to ignore the neutrality of those countries. Their plans by the British and French for the seizure of ore fields in the months of January and February were not implemented because the French in particular were diverted by Russia's war against Finland. But the Allied, or that is the British and French invasion of Norway and the German invasion of Norway, were therefore almost simultaneously. The Germans were better led, better equipped, better trained, and more dedicated, and they prevailed. But to hold the German leaders at Nuremberg responsible for aggression or crimes against peace for the invasion of Norway is one good example of the hypocritical double standard of the Nuremberg Tribunal. In August 1941, Britain and the Soviet Union jointly invaded and occupied Iran, which at that time was a neutral country. Given this record, it's hardly surprising that the four governments, that organized the Nuremberg Tribunal of 1945-1946 included no definition of aggression in the tribunal's charter. That permitted them, therefore, to apply the term aggression however they saw fit and apply it selectively. Mikhail Voslensky, a Soviet historian who served as a translator at the Nuremberg Tribunal in 1946, later recalled that he and other Soviet personnel felt out of place there because the alleged crimes of the German leaders were what he called the norm of our life in the Soviet Union. The Soviet role in the proceedings, which the United States fully supported, moved American diplomat and historian George Kennan to condemn the entire Nuremberg enterprise as a horror and a mockery. The double standard of the Allied powers at Nuremberg was condemned at the time by the British weekly, The Economist. It pointed out that whereas both Britain and France had supported the expulsion of the Soviet Union from the League of Nations in 1939 for its unprovoked attack against Finland, just 6 years later, these same two governments were cooperating with the USSR as a respected equal at Nuremberg. An editorial in The Economist went on, I'm quoting, "Nor should the Western world console itself that the Russians alone stand condemned at the bar of the Allies' own justice." The British Weekly went on, and I quote, "Among crimes against humanity stands the offense of the indiscriminate bombing of civilian populations. Can the Americans who dropped the atom bomb and the British who destroyed the cities of Western Germany plead not guilty on that count? Crimes against humanity also include the mass expulsion of populations. Can the Anglo-Saxon leaders who at Potsdam condoned the expulsion of millions of Germans from their homes hold themselves completely innocent? The nations sitting in judgment at Nuremberg have so clearly proclaimed themselves exempt from the law which they have administered." Unquote. One official with the post-war U.S. Military Occupation Administration in Germany commented, and I quote, "What good are the high-flown morals enunciated at Nuremberg if the Americans have agreed to such things as deportation in documents which bear official signatures and which therefore give the Allies the legal right to do the things which at Nuremberg they described as immoral?" If the Nuremberg Tribunal's standards had been applied to the victors of the Second World War, American General and Supreme Allied Commander in Europe Dwight Eisenhower, later President, would have been hanged. At the end of the war, Eisenhower ordered that German prisoners in American military custody were no longer to be treated according to the Geneva Convention on the Treatment of Prisoners of War. This violation of international law removed masses of Germans from the protection of the International Committee of the Red Cross and condemned hundreds of thousands of them to death by starvation and disease. Nothing better illustrates the essentially unfair character of the Nuremberg Tribunal's proceedings than the treatment of Rudolf Hess, Hitler's deputy. He was sentenced to life imprisonment by the Nuremberg Tribunal, even though he alone of leading figures of the countries involved in the Second World War risked his life in a dangerous but fruitless effort to conclude peace between two of the warring nations. British historian A.J.P. Taylor once succinctly summed up the injustice of the Hess case and, by implication, of the entire Nuremberg enterprise. Taylor wrote, quote, "Hess came to this country in 1941 as an ambassador of peace. He came with the intention of restoring peace between Great Britain and Germany. He acted in good faith. He fell into our hands and was quite unjustly treated as a prisoner of war. After the war, we should have released him. Instead, the British government of the time delivered him for sentencing to the International Tribunal at Nuremberg. No crime has ever been proved against Hess. As far as the records show, he was never at even one of the secret discussions at which Hitler explained his war plans. Other examples of the essential injustice of the Nuremberg Tribunal are in the case of the German of the condemnation by the Allies at Nuremberg of German bombing policy during World War II. But in fact, the beginning of indiscriminate bombing of civilians was carried out not by Germany, but by Britain. If the rules had been reversed, the Allied prosecutors and judges at Nuremberg would have been themselves brought to the dock and punished for their policy with regard to bombing in World War II. A British Air Ministry directive to the Royal Air Force Bomber Command in February 1942 read, and I'm quoting, "It has been decided that the primary object of your operations should now be focused on the morale of the civilian population, and in particular of industrial workers. With this aim in view, a list of selected area targets is attached." Unquote. Well, this British policy of area or carpet or terror bombing became the principal strategic method used by the Royal Air Force of waging war against Germany. The date of the directive is significant because it was at that time, February 1942, when British fortunes in the war were at a virtual lowest point. The British had lost Singapore with 80,000 troops. They had been defeated in the desert in northern Africa. They had failed to prevent two German battlecruisers, the Scharnhorst and Gneisenauer, from sailing up the channel to their home ports. And so, prompted by Arthur Harris, who was chief of Bomber Command for the British Air Force, the bomber offensive against Germany became the centerpiece of British strategy and remained so for the best part of several more years of the war. But area bombing, begun as a policy by the British, involved the deliberate destruction of entire districts. It was directed against the morale of civilian populations by killing them as many as possible. The firestorm created in Hamburg by the Royal Air Force in its raid in July 1943 killed some 40,000 civilians and rendered another 900,000 homeless. And, of course, better well known is the Anglo-American attack against Dresden in February 1945, which wiped out an open city, inflicting somewhere in the region of an estimated 80,000 to as high as 200,000 fatal casualties. The German air attack against Rotterdam in 1940 resulted in about 900 dead and was entirely within the province and legitimacy of regular warfare at that time. It was not an attack deliberately carried out against civilians. But the immense double standard of the Allies is highlighted by this hypocrisy with regard to bombing policy during World War II. In a book about the Battle of Hamburg by a British historian, a survivor is quoted about the effects of the Allied attack of July 1943. This eyewitness wrote, "Women and children were so charred as to be unrecognizable. Those that had died through lack of oxygen were half charred and unrecognizable. Their brains tumbled from their burst temples and their insides from the soft parts under the ribs. The smallest children lay like fried eels on the pavement. Even in the death, they showed signs of how they must have suffered, their hands and arms outstretched as to protect them from that pitiless heat." Well, imagine if the Germans had been able to put the Allies on trial for their actions with regard to air bombing during World War II. The documents that we now know from the British and American archives would have been enough to put British leaders and American leaders to death for their actions during the war. The Allied bombing campaign was so unjust that it was also a violation of a principle laid out by the Nuremberg Tribunal that policies that are orders that are clearly illegal should not be obeyed, should not be followed. In fact, the main German daily newspaper, the Völkische Beobachter, the central paper of the National Socialist Party, wrote in an article by Goebbels, the propaganda minister, in May 1944, he wrote, "The Allied pilots cannot validly claim that as soldiers they obeyed orders. No law of war provides that a soldier will remain unpunished for a hateful crime by referring to the orders of the superior, if their orders are in striking opposition to all human ethics, to all international customs in the conduct of war." Now, that comment could have come from the Allied Prosecuting Council at Nuremberg when they were going against, of course, the German defendants. But that principle was not applied, of course, to the Allies. Another example of the hypocrisy of the Allies is that one of the claims made is that the German government was subverting the influence of the churches over people. Well, this was especially outrageous, given that the Soviet Union, of course, was ruled by leaders who were universally atheist and did everything in their power to eliminate entirely and destroy the role of the churches in the Soviet Union and in the territories under their control. But in fact, whatever the feelings of some of the German leaders during the 1930s and 1940s, the German state not only protected but fostered the influence and the role of the major Christian churches in Germany during that period of time, and guaranteed and enforced this this guarantee with law, the right of religious freedom and of religious proselytizing in Germany during the Third Reich era. One of the more outrageous claims made against the German leaders was that they had tried to impose a so-called master race theory in Germany. This was another absolutely ridiculous charge made by the Allies that several of the defendants tried, but in vain, to repudiate and refute during their time on the stand as defendants. And yet another was the claim that the Germans had carried out so-called unrestricted submarine warfare, another policy that the Allies themselves had carried out during the war. In fact, so hypocritical was this point that one of the German attorneys, Kranzbühler, who was the attorney for Alfred Dönitz, succeeded in this one case of making the point that the Allies themselves had carried out a policy which they had condemned, which they were condemning the Germans for. That is the claim that the Germans carried out unrestricted submarine warfare against civilians. Well, that concludes this first half of this broadcast. We'll return in a few minutes with the second half of this portion of the Mark Weber Report. Hello and welcome back. At Nuremberg, another major claim made against the German defendants was that they had sought war and conquest against the United States of America. Well, in fact, and this was brought out under testimony and with documents and has later been confirmed by historians and other documents, the German government in 1940-41, of course before that, did everything to avoid conflict and war with the United States of America. In fact, this went so far that even though American destroyers in the summer of 1941 had been given orders by the American government to attack German submarines, that is, at a time when the United States was supposedly neutral, and therefore itself a violation of international law, completely also carried out on the basis of deceit by the American leaders, the German government and the German Navy was forbidden to attack even British destroyers if they were involved with Americans, to avoid any submarine mistake of attacking an American ship for a British ship. High-level British official, Admiral Little, head of the British Admiralty delegation in Washington, reported in July 1941 to his superiors in London, and I'm quoting, "The brightest hope for getting the Americans into the war lies in the escorting arrangements to Iceland, and let us hope the Germans will not be slow in attacking them. Otherwise, I think it would be best for us to organize an attack by our submarines on the escort." In other words, to carry out a British attack to provoke the Germans or blame them. But perhaps the British official here was being somewhat facetious, but the essential point was both the British and the Americans in the summer of 1941 were doing everything they could to create an incident that would enable the British and Americans, and especially the Americans, to claim that the Germans were out to go to war against the United States. But in fact, the German command was ordered to do everything in their power to avoid conflict with the U.S. during this period of time, even when they were provoked by American ships operating together with the British. At the Nuremberg Tribunal, and in preparation for it, the victorious Allies thoroughly scoured Germany for every scrap of paper that might be used to incriminate the defeated regime. Never before or since has a nation's records been so completely ransacked. In addition to official government papers, including countless secret documents tracing Germany's wartime Jewish policy, the Allies confiscated the records of the National Socialist Party and its affiliated organizations, as well as those of numerous private business firms, institutions, and individuals. The sheer quantity of paper seized by the Allies is staggering. For example, the records of the German Foreign Office alone, confiscated by the U.S. officials, amounted to some 485 tons of paper. From this mountain of paper, U.S. military personnel alone selected some 2,000 documents considered most incriminating for use at the main Nuremberg trial. The tons of confiscated records were later shipped to the United States. It's estimated that in the U.S. National Archives alone, there were more than 1 million pages of documents on the Third Reich's Jewish policy. It's as if a government's hostile to the United States today were to seize the top secret files of the Pentagon and CIA and then selectively publish the most embarrassing and incriminating documents from that vast collection. Well, of course, in the years since the Nuremberg trials, historians of many different countries have carefully sifted through the German records, including countless documents that were not available to the Nuremberg prosecutors. Historians have been able to compare and cross-check the records of different German ministries and agencies, as well as numerous private diaries and papers. It's important to emphasize that out of this great mass of paper, not a single document has ever been found that confirms or even refers to a German plan for so-called world conquest, which was a claim made repeatedly and incessantly by U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt and other high-ranking American officials before, during, and after World War II. At Nuremberg, the German documents were in the custody of the Allied prosecutors who did not permit defense attorneys to make their own selections of the material. Historian Werner Maser has pointed out that at Nuremberg, and I'm quoting, thousands of documents which seemed likely to possibly to incriminate the Allies and exonerate the defendants suddenly disappeared. There is much evidence that documents were confiscated, concealed from the defense, or even stolen in 1945. Other important documents suddenly disappeared when specifically requested by German defense attorneys. I can speak about this somewhat from my own experience. Some years ago, when I was doing a lot of research work in Washington, D.C., officials at the National Archives confirmed to me on several occasions that the originals of numerous Nuremberg documents had been lost and remain lost to this day. The tribunal refused to allow in evidence several collections of German and captured foreign documents published during the war as German Foreign Office white books. Moreover, most of the 1,809 affidavits prepared by the Nuremberg defense attorneys and teams have never been made public. After the Nuremberg tribunal pronounced its sentence, German ex-foreign minister von Ribbentrop pointed out some of the obstacles put up in his particular case, and I'm quoting, "The defense had no fair chance to defend German foreign policy. Our prepared application for the submission of evidence was not allowed. Without good cause being shown, half of the 300 documents which the defense prepared were not admitted. Witnesses and affidavits were only admitted after the prosecution had been heard. Most of them were rejected. Correspondence between Hitler and Chamberlain, reports by ambassadors and diplomatic minutes, etc., were rejected. Only the prosecution, not the defense, had access to German and foreign archives. The prosecution alone only searched for incriminating documents, and their use was biased. It knowingly concealed exonerating documents and withheld them from the defense." Unquote. The charter of the International Military Tribunal permitted the use of normally inadmissible evidence. Article 19, for example, specified that the tribunal shall not be bound by technical rules of evidence and shall admit any evidence which it deems to have probative value. Article 21 said the tribunal shall not require proof of facts of common knowledge but shall take judicial notice thereof. It shall also take judicial notice of official governmental documents and reports of the United Nations, that is, the Allied countries, including acts and documents of the committees set up in the various Allied countries for the investigation of war crimes and the records and findings of military and other tribunals of any of the United, that is, Allied nations. Well, on the basis of these articles, the tribunal accepted as valid the most dubious evidence, including hearsay and unsubstantiated reports of Soviet and American so-called investigative commissions. For example, the tribunal accepted an American congressional report that supposedly proved gas chamber killings at Dachau and a Polish government report submitted by the United States that proved, supposedly, killings by steam at Treblinka. Today, no reputable historian accepts either of these stories. In addition, the tribunal validated Soviet reports about Auschwitz and Majdanek. These were documents USSR 8 and USSR 29, which explained in detail how the Germans had killed, supposedly, 4 million at Auschwitz and another 1.5 million at Majdanek. Today, no reputable historian accepts either of these fantastic figures. German guilt for the killing of thousands of Polish officers in the Katyn Forest near Smolensk were similarly confirmed by Nuremberg document USSR 54. This detailed report by an official Soviet so-called investigative commission was submitted as proof for the charge made in the joint indictment of the four Allied governments. It wasn't until 1990 that the Soviet government finally acknowledged that the Katyn massacre was carried out not by a German unit, as supposedly proven at Nuremberg, but rather by the Soviet secret police. It is sometimes claimed that the evidence presented by the prosecution to the Nuremberg Tribunal was so incontrovertible that none of the defense attorneys ever disputed the authenticity or accuracy of prosecution documents. This is simply not true. Not only did the defense attorneys protest against the prosecution's use of spurious documents, but some of the most important Nuremberg documents are now widely acknowledged to be fraudulent. A good example is Nuremberg document USSR 378, which is a purported record of numerous private conversations with Hitler by Hermann Rauschning, a former National Socialist official in Danzig. Supposedly, Hitler revealed to this man, often in brutal and cynical language, his most intimate thoughts and secret plans for supposed world conquest. Rauschning's supposed memoir was published in 1939 in Britain under the title Hitler Speaks, and in the United States in 1940 under the title The Voice of Destruction. It was this U.S. edition that was accepted in evidence at Nuremberg as proof of what the Allies called the guiding principles of the Nazi regime. Chief Prosecutor for Great Britain, Sir Hartley Shawcross, and his Soviet colleagues cited numerous quotations from the supposed Rauschning memoir. One of the defendants, Baldur von Schirach, contested the authenticity of this document. It wasn't until 1983 that Swiss historian Wolfgang Hennel established that this memoir is entirely fraudulent. Rauschning, in fact, never had even a single private meeting with Hitler. Another fraudulent Nuremberg document is the so-called Hossbach Protocol. That was document 386 PS, a purported record of a high-level 1937 conference at which Hitler supposedly revealed his secret plans for aggressive conquest. U.S. Nuremberg prosecutor Sidney Alderman called this one of the most striking and revealing of all the captured documents, and told the tribunal that it removed any remaining doubts about the guilt of the German leaders for their crimes against peace. It was largely on the basis of this document that Chief Defendant Hermann Göring was condemned to death. Well, Jewish historian Lucy Davidowitz, author of The War Against the Jews, acknowledged, quote, "There were also Holocaust documents that are outright falsification and some that purvey myth rather than historical fact." In fact, much of the evidence for the Holocaust presented at Nuremberg and in subsequent trials has been so-called survivor testimony. But as numerous historians have acknowledged, such testimony is often defective. Historian Gerald Reitlinger cautioned readers of his detailed study, The Final Solution, that Nuremberg evidence, including Holocaust evidence, including Nuremberg documents and testimony, cannot be accepted at face value. Reitlinger wrote, "A certain degree of reserve is necessary in handling all this material, and particularly this applies to the last section, survivor narratives. The Eastern European Jew is a natural rhetorician, speaking in flowery similes." Jewish historian Hannah Arendt observed in her book Eichmann in Jerusalem that the eyewitnesses who testified in the 1961 trial in Jerusalem of Adolf Eichmann were only rarely able to distinguish between what actually happened to them years earlier and what they had read, heard, or imagined in the meantime. We now know that witnesses at the main Nuremberg trial gave false testimony. Perhaps the most obvious were the three witnesses who ostensibly confirmed German guilt
for the Katyn massacre of Polish officers. Stephen F. Pinter of St. Louis, Missouri, served as a U.S. Army prosecuting attorney from January 1946 to July 1947 at the American trials of Germans at Dachau. Together, some 420 Germans were sentenced to death in these Dachau trials. In a 1960 affidavit, Stephen Pinter stated, quote, "Notoriously perjured witnesses were used to charge Germans with false and unfounded crimes. Unfortunately, as a result of these miscarriages of justice, many innocent persons were convicted and some were executed." A young U.S. Army court reporter at the Dachau trials in 1947, Joseph Hallow, a man who, by the way, I got to know rather well, later recalled the unwholesome situation. Quote, "The witnesses in the concentration camp cases were virtually all of the sort we court reporters termed professional witnesses, those who spent months in Dachau testifying one or another against one or another of the many accused. It was to their economic advantage to testify, and many of them made a good living doing so. As one might well imagine, the motive of the professional witnesses was also one of spite and revenge. In many instances, their vengeance included relating exaggerated accounts of what they had witnessed. It also included outright lying." In the 1947 Nordhausen Dora case, American defense attorney Major Leon Pulata protested against the general unreliability and frequent outright lying of prosecution witnesses in this U.S. military trial of former concentration camp officials. Allied prosecutors used torture to help prove their case at Nuremberg and at other post-war trials. Former Auschwitz Commandant Rudolf Höss was tortured by British officials into signing a false and self-incriminating confession that has been widely cited as a key document of Holocaust extermination. His testimony before the Nuremberg Tribunal, a high point of the proceeding, was perhaps the most striking and memorable evidence presented there of a German extermination program. Höss maintained that 2.5 million people had been killed in Auschwitz gas chambers, and that another 500,000 inmates had died there of other causes. No serious or reputable historian now accepts either of these fantastic figures, and other key portions of Hearst's confession are now generally acknowledged to be untrue. Fritz Sauckel, head of the German wartime labor mobilization program, was sentenced to death at the main Nuremberg trial. An important piece of evidence presented to the tribunal by U.S. prosecution was an affidavit signed by the defendant. This was document 3057-PS. It turned out that Sauckel had put his signature to the self-incriminating document, which had been presented to him by his captors in finished form only after he was bluntly told that if he hesitated, his wife and children would be turned over to the Soviets. Sauckel later declared, quote, "I did not stop to consider, and thinking of my family, I signed the document." Hans Fritzsche, another defendant in the main Nuremberg tribunal, was similarly forced to sign a self-damning confession while he was a prisoner of the Soviet secret police in Moscow. Nuremberg defendant Julius Streicher, who was eventually hanged because he published a sometimes sensational anti-Jewish weekly paper, was brutally mistreated following his arrest. He was badly beaten, kicked, whipped, spat at, forced to drink saliva, and burned with cigarettes. His genitals were beaten. Eyebrow and chest hair were pulled out. He was stripped and photographed. Fellow defendant Hans Frank was savagely beaten by two GIs shortly after his arrest. Although most of the defendants at the main Nuremberg trial were not tortured, many other Germans were forced to sign affidavits and give testimony against their former colleagues and superiors. A simple threat to turn the subject over to the Soviets was often enough to persuade him to sign an affidavit or provide testimony needed in court. Threats against the subject's wife and children, including withdrawal of ration cards, delivery to the Soviets, or imprisonment, often quickly produced the desired results. If all else failed, the subject could be placed in solitary confinement, beaten, kicked, whipped, or burned until he broke down. Reports of widespread torture at the post-war American-run war crimes trial at Dachau leaked out, resulting in so many protests that a formal investigation was eventually carried out. A U.S. Army Commission of Inquiry consisting of Pennsylvania Judge Edward von Roden and Texas Supreme Court Judge Gordon Simpson officially confirmed the charges of gross abuse. German defendants, they found, were routinely tortured at Dachau with savage beatings, burning matches under fingernails, kicking of testicles, months of solitary confinement, and threats of family reprisals. One of the most important and revealing Nuremberg cases is that of Oswald Pohl, the wartime head of the vast SS agency that ran the German concentration camps. After his capture in 1946, he was taken to Nendorf, where British soldiers tied him to a chair and beat him unconscious. He lost two teeth in repeated beatings. He was then transferred to Nuremberg, where American military officials intensively interrogated him for more than half a year in sessions that lasted for hours. Altogether, there were about 70 such sessions. Pohl later protested against his treatment and the way in which he had been forced to sign self-incriminating documents. The Nuremberg Enterprise violated ancient and fundamental principles of justice. The victorious Allies acted as prosecutor, judge, and executioner of the German leaders. The charges were created especially for the occasion and were applied only to the vanquished. Defeated, starving, prostrate Germany was, however, in no position to oppose whatever the Allied occupation powers, demanded. Even some leading Allied figures privately acknowledged at the time that the Nuremberg trials were organized not to dispense impartial justice, but for political purposes. Sir Norman Birkert, British alternate judge at the Nuremberg Tribunal, explained in a private letter in April 1946, and I'm quoting, "The trial is only in form a judicial process, and its main importance is political." Indicative of the largely political nature of the Nuremberg process was the important Jewish role in organizing these trials. Nahum Goldman, one-time president of both the World Jewish Congress and the World Zionist Organization, reported in his memoir that the Nuremberg Tribunal was the brainchild of World Jewish Congress officials. Only after persistent effort were officials of this organization able to persuade Allied leaders to accept the idea, he added. Some of the Americans who participated in the Nuremberg tribunals became disillusioned with the entire business. One of the few to make public his feelings was Charles Winterstrom, an Iowa State Supreme Court justice who served as presiding judge in the Nuremberg trial of German generals. Perhaps the most courageous condemnation of the trials was by U.S. Senator Robert Taft, widely regarded as the conscience of the Republican Party in those days. At considerable risk to his political career, he denounced the Nuremberg Enterprise in an October 1946. "The trial of the vanquished by the victors cannot be impartial no matter how it is hedged about with the forms of justice," he said. And he went on, "About this whole judgment, there is a spirit of revenge, and revenge is seldom justice. The hanging of the 11 men convicted will be a blot on the American record, which we will long regret. In these trials, we have accepted the Russian idea of the purpose of trials, government policy, and not justice, with little relation to Anglo-Saxon heritage. By clothing policy in the forms of judicial procedure, we may discredit the whole idea of justice in Europe for years to come." Again, the Nuremberg Tribunal dispensed not justice, but injustice. The hangings of German leaders ordered by the Nuremberg Tribunal were little more than murders that were made palatable with a veneer of pseudo-legality. That concludes this broadcast of the Mark Weber Report. Thank you, and I hope you'll join us for the next broadcast.